Hello and welcome to the lecture component of Nations of Charlemagne, episode 14, Charles V's Universal Monarchy. I hope you all enjoy the lecture. In Bologna, on the 24th of February 1530, Charles was crowned Holy Roman Emperor by Clement VII, the last occasion whence a King of the Romans was directly crowned by the Pope. As befitting an act of such gravity and symbolism, the coronation ceremony recalled the obligations and mythology of medieval kingship. Constantine, Charlemagne, and Sigismund, the founder of the Order of the Dragon and the battler of the Ottoman Turks in Nicopolis, were the examples set up in effigy for the new emperor to follow. Prior to receiving his imperial dignity, Charles was already first among Europe's princes, lord over a vast collection of dynastic possessions, the like of which Europe had not seen since the Carolingian Empire, the legacy of the successful dynastic politics of his paternal grandfather and imperial predecessor, Maximilian I. Charles, by the grace of God, Emperor of the Romans, forever august, was the titular King of Germany, the King of Italy, having received the ancient iron crown of Lombardy alongside his imperial one at Bologna. After the success of his forces at Pavia, this title was no empty boast, as he possessed the kingdoms of Naples, Sicily, and Sardinia, the inheritance and conquest of his maternal grandfather, Ferdinand of Aragon, and would later incorporate the Duchy of Milan, the heart of the north, into the Habsburg fold. Having received a mass of holdings in the Low Countries from the Burgundian inheritance of his paternal grandmother, Mary of Burgundy, Charles would unite these territories into a single nation within the Holy Roman Empire, the 17 provinces, the predecessor of the modern-day nations of the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and Belgium, with a significant portion of northern and eastern France. From Maximilian I, Charles inherited the core Habsburg lands in Austria, lands that would be augmented by Bohemia and Hungary under his brother, regent, and successor, Ferdinand I, the foundation of what historians would later refer to as the Habsburg monarchy. But the grandest of all his inheritances was that of Spain, Castile, Aragon, and Granada, possessions he held jointly with his mother Joanna, a queen sadly rendered unfit to rule owing to her debilitating depression, caused in part by the treatment she received from her husband when he was alive and exacerbated by his death, Charles's own father, Philip the Handsome. European Spain alone was a formidable economic and military power, enough to rival the Kingdom of France, Charles's greatest Christian rival. But with the Spanish inheritance came with it the Spanish conquest in the Americas. Spain, from its possessions in Cuba and Hispaniola, under Charles would conquer Mexico from the Aztecs under Hernan Cortes and Peru from the Incas under Pizarro, acquiring for Charles and his Spanish successor, Philip II, the New World's vast quantity of gold and silver, let alone all the exotic goods new to European markets. The first empire upon which the sun would never set. It is no wonder that Charles would adopt the heraldic emblem of the Pillars of Hercules, the terminus of the Mediterranean, conjoined with the motto plus ultra, meaning further beyond, that now supports the modern Spanish coat of arms. From this position of strength, Charles had the potential to realize the dreams of Frederick Barbarossa and Frederick II Stupa Mundi, a new Pax Romana, or peace in Christendom, a Dominum Mundi, the realization of the project of the Ghibellines and the arguments in Dante's De Monarchia, that of a Christian universal monarch with the Pope as his subordinate. Nevertheless, his elevation coincided with the Lutheran Revolution in Germany, the rise of the Turkish Ottoman Empire under Suleiman the Magnificent, and the ascension of the ambitious King Francis of France, eager to reverse Habsburg gains in Italy and Europe. Within his composite empire, Charles had to manage the interest of various local magnates in his respective realms, while Germany had already undergone a process of rapid decentralization prior to his birth. Within the House of Habsburg, Charles had to contend with the ambitions of his brother Ferdinand. After a hollow victory in Germany against the Lutherans, Charles conceded to the Protestants with the Peace of Augsburg and to his brother Ferdinand with the division of his lands into Spanish and Austrian inheritances. While Charles left the Habsburgs in an enviable position at his abdication, the prospects for a universal monarchy floundered, ever diminishing through the succeeding generations of Austrian and Spanish princes, culminating in the disaster of the Thirty Years' War. Charles was born into the Flemish metropolis of Ghent in 1500, Thereafter, he was known as Charles of Ghent until his election. The young prince grew up alienated from his parents in Spain. His father had died when he was six, causing his mother to exile herself to the citadel Tordesillas, always near to her husband's coffin. Charles's aunt, Margaret, became his regent in Burgundy. Charles's youthful appearance was immortalized by Strigel's family of Emperor Maximilian I. At the time of the painting's composition, Charles's underbite, the classic Habsburg jaw, was so pronounced, combined with the loss of his front teeth from a carriage accident, that his mouth permanently gaped. It was remarked by one courtier that the young prince should take care lest insolent blue-bottle fly settled in his throat. Combined with his pale complexion and his bulging eyes, observers took his appearance as a sign of mental retardation. Nevertheless, the young prince was a model of Christian piety, an avid horseman and hunter, though he preferred the Burgundian dramas of courtly romance to academic study. The court of Burgundy was dominated by merchants, the consequence of the region's wealth and the preponderance of great urban centres, such as Bruges and Mechelen. With the ascent of Duchess Mary of Burgundy, the estates, led by the city of Ghent, had insisted on a great charter, a Magna Carta, as a precondition of her rule. Her father, Charles the Bald, had attempted to unite the disparate states of the Netherlands into a kingdom with its own French model parliament at Mechelen, an aspiration thwarted by the Duke's military demands at Nancy. As a consequence of his defeat, the rump Burgundian Netherlands was fervently particularistic, their localities enjoying their own governments, laws and parliaments. The merchants and nobilities were sated by the grant of military commands and state offices, not to mention membership of the prestigious Order of the Golden Fleece. Nevertheless, during Charles's regency, the nobility under de Croix gravitated towards France to thwart Margaret of Austria, end the regency, and declared the young Charles of age to rule the Netherlands in the hope that the young prince would prove more pliant than his aunt. In 1516 in Spain, Ferdinand, Charles's maternal grandfather, died, having ruled over Aragon and indirectly over his daughter's kingdom of Castile, leading to Charles's proclamation as King of Spain while he was still resident in the Netherlands. To prevent a war with France, de Croix promptly concluded a treaty, eyeing up the prospect of power in Spain through Charles. With a Burgundian-led administration over the kingdom, de Croix advised Charles to snub the powerful Spanish nobility, organizing the Castilian Cortes at Valladolid, ignoring the demands of the Cortes that Charles make an effort to learn Castilian, naturalize himself as a Spaniard, or be financially cut off. Charles therefore rewarded de Croix and his Burgundian entourage, even naming de Croix's nephew as the Archbishop of Toledo, the wealthiest see in Spain. In Germany, Maximilian I, the great imperialist seat, had forged a Habsburg imperial mythology through the poetry of works such as the Teuerdank and the White King, and the monumental block prince of Albrecht Dürer, elevating the Burgundian court culture that he gained through marriage to Mary. Nevertheless, Maximilian was also a great political reformer, arresting the process of declining imperial authority that had begun during the Great Interregnum, and was ratified by the concessions of the Golden Bull of 1356. Institutions such as the Imperial Diet or Reichstag had a precedent before even the era of the Carolingians, yet seldom has such an institution evolved into part of the machinery of government, like the Paris Parlement or the English Parliament. Imitating the underlying principles of those institutions, that of feudal concordance between the emperor and the estates, the emperor convoked the Diet of Worms to establish a common penny or imperial taxes in the event of war. The perpetual public peace was established to end feuds. The Reichskammergericht was established as a supreme court under the emperor, who held supreme jurisdiction over justice. To deal with the complex and convoluted system of administration that had resulted from the collapse of many of the stem duchies from the 13th century, imperial circles were established for common defence and taxation, and a means of representation in the Reichstag and Reichskammergericht. By the time of Maximilian's death, the emperor was possessed of significant resources and political rights. Moreover, there was yet a state in Germany which had consolidated enough power to challenge the Habsburgs and their possession of Austria. Saxony had divided in 1489, while the Wittelsbachs of Bavaria had only recently reunified. The various city leagues of the free and imperial cities, while sometimes at odds with the emperor, often acted as a brake on the regional consolidation of any would-be rival to the emperor. If cooperation with the leagues failed, the emperor could rely on the Reichsritter, imperial knights, who owed immediacy to the emperor, not a local lord or authority. An aspect of the Reichsreform abandoned by Maximilian was that of the Reichsregiment, or Imperial Council, nominally a body to assist in imperial rule, that it could instead act as a brake on it. With Maximilian's death, Charles offered to restore the Reichskammergericht as a condition for his election. Much emphasis has been placed by historians such as Rady on the campaign for the 1519 election of the King of the Romans, citing the competition from Francis of France and even Henry VIII of England. What needs to be emphasized here is that, more than anything, this was a foregone conclusion for Charles that he would be elected. Had any other outcome presented itself, it would have represented a complete departure from 100 years of precedent, erasing the legacy of three previous emperors, ignoring the growing animosity between the emperor and France, and that the impetus for Reichsreform from Maximilian and his predecessor Sigismund focused on securing the empire's frontiers against France. The payments of Jacob Fugger, who would later claim that he had gifted the imperial throne to Charles, act as a guarantee of a smooth transition of power to the only dynastically acceptable candidate. Charles's offer of an unprecedented so-called capitulation to the rights of the princes is entirely consistent with allaying the anxieties of local interests in Germany, who are cautious to empower someone who was already lord of the Netherlands and king of Spain, as well as its dominions in Italy. On the contrary, what Charles offered as concessions, such as the restoration of the Reichsregiment, acted to facilitate Habsburg power in the empire, as intended in the first decade of his reign, especially as Charles spent that period in Spain. Likewise, the Reichskammergericht was used as a judicial instrument against Protestant princes. There was a concrete utility in monarchs granting great charters, Magna Carta, or conceding capitulations upon accession, in order that a monarch may amend or revoke it later from a position of strength. Charles's grandmother, Mary of Burgundy, had done so, thus securing her inheritance, while Charles V, Mary's ultimate successor, completely undermined the stipulations of the charter she had signed with his pragmatic sanction of 1549, ordering the Burgundian circle into the 17 provinces. The reign of Edward I of England can be seen as a monarchical corrective to the impotence of John and Henry III, the former having conceded Magna Carta, while the latter fought against the barons. Upon his election, Charles departed for Spain by way of England and was crowned king, departed from Spain by way of England and was crowned King of the Romans in Charlemagne's Cathedral of Aachen. As part of the formal capitulation, Charles summoned the Diet of Worms, achieving his desire for the Reichsregiment to manage imperial affairs in his interests while he was absent. Martin Luther had begun his contest with papal authority 4 years prior in Wittenberg, and thanks to the advent of the printing press, his works were widely disseminated and popular in Germany, with little objection from secular authorities. The Diet of Worms coincided with the papacy's offensive against Luther, which had issued a bull, excommunicated Luther, and sent a nuncio, Aleander, to petition the emperor. As Luther was under the protection of Frederick, Elector of Saxony, he could not simply outlaw Luther, instead affording Luther a heresy trial as an adjunct to the main proceedings of the Diet. Charles and Aleander, however, pronounced a ban on Luther regardless, a ban, of course, being a writ of outlawry in the Holy Roman Empire, which was met by such a backlash that a trial became a necessity. The trial became an opportunity for Luther to profess his theology to the princes of the empire, to which the emperor penned his own denunciation of Luther and issued the ban with the agreement of the estates. In Charles's denunciation of Luther, we see that wedded to Charles's conception of Catholicism is the importance of tradition and dynasty, that the Catholic faith, being the religion of his illustrious forebears, must be retained, lest the Reformation declare his ancestors to have been in error all along. It is now that we turn to Ferdinand. Raised in Spain and only meeting his brother Charles for the first time in 1517, Ferdinand was a central component in Maximilian's dynastic strategy. Where Charles had acquired Burgundy, Spain, and would inherit Austria, Ferdinand would gain the crowns of Bohemia and Hungary. Briefly Habsburg possessions under Albert the Magnanimous and Ladislaus the Posthumous, Maximilian re-exerted Habsburg claims to these nations through the First Congress of Vienna, whereby Ferdinand was wed to the daughter of the King of Hungary and Bohemia, Vladislaus, and the King's son, later Louis II, would be married to Charles and Ferdinand's younger sister, Anna. As Charles had now concluded his business in Germany and was set to return to Spain, Ferdinand was the ideal figure to act as regent in the empire. To secure his brother's support and power in the empire, Charles awarded the Habsburg hereditary lands to him, not as a viceroy, but as Ferdinand's own hereditary possessions, while Ferdinand was elevated to the rank of Archduke. In part, this had been motivated by a desire to induce Vladislaus of Bohemia and Hungary to honour the Congress of Vienna and perform the royal marriages, which promptly occurred. Nevertheless, Charles agreed further to the quid pro quo that upon the coronation of his own coronation by the Pope as Holy Roman Emperor, Ferdinand would be elected King of the Romans and heir to the empire. At the time, Charles was unmarried and without legitimate issue, so there was a political impetus to confirm his brother, his closest male relative, as heir. However, upon Charles's later production of an heir, Philip II, the effect of the Compact of Brussels was not only to divide the Habsburg lands into perpetuity, but disinherit the descendants of Charles from the imperial title. At first, the regency government of Ferdinand fared well. Having gained the support of the princes, Ferdinand even managed to relocate the centre of imperial government from the free imperial city of Nuremberg to Habsburg-Islingen. The turning point came in the German Peasants' War. The Peasants' War was fought in opposition to the excesses of and infringement on peasant rights by the local princes, and yet it was combined with Protestant rhetoric, not from Luther, who disowned the movement and later penned the infamous Against the Murderous and Thieving Hordes of Peasants, but from the Anabaptists, led by Thomas Munzer. Ferdinand, the Swabian League, and the local princes proved to be natural allies against the social revolt, and yet the subsequent substantial loss of peasant freedoms, owing to the defeat of the peasants, meant that the princes had achieved the consolidation of their domains necessary to oppose the Habsburgs. The defeat of the peasants coincided with the conversion of princes such as Philip of Hesse and John of Saxony to Lutheranism, and others en masse, leading to the dispossession of church lands and revenues, measures even imitated by secularizing Catholic princes. In defiance of imperial power and the ban on Luther imposed by the Edict of Worms, Hesse and Saxony organized into a military alliance, the League of Thurgau. The Diet of Speyer confirmed this impasse in Germany. The movement towards Reichsreform, of cooperation between the princes and the emperor, had failed, and the Reichsregiment, designed to facilitate Habsburg rule in the empire, was now defunct. Ferdinand himself took no further action against the Protestants. With the fallout of the Ottoman victory at Mohács, Ferdinand, now King of Hungary and Bohemia, was focused on defending the frontiers of Christendom against the Turks. Only an intervention by Charles personally could rescue the collapsing Habsburg authority in Germany. Returning now to Charles in Spain, in Charles's absence, the Comunero revolt had broken out. The Comunero revolt was partially motivated in opposition to the Burgundian officers of state, a Spanish separatist movement against their elusive foreign king and his hated French-speaking favourite de Croix. At the same time, the Comuneros were a movement of the guilds and the urban centres in opposition to the excessive privileges afforded to the nobility by the Castilians for decades, including the ad hoc noble confiscation of commoner land. The Comuneros were militarily defeated, with the centre of their rebellion in Toledo eventually surrendering. Nevertheless, Charles had deduced his error in empowering de Croix in the first place, while a Spanish junta, erected to facilitate Charles's rule in Spain, advocated for sweeping reforms in the nation's finances and empowerment of the Cortes, a programme which directly challenged royal authority. Nevertheless, Charles seized upon the reform programme, not as a means of empowering the parliament, but of weakening the aristocracy who had crushed the Comuneros, in stark contrast to what had just happened in Germany. The great aristocracy, or grandees of Spain, were barred from serving in the government of Castile proper, while the lower nobility and merchants were empowered at their expense. Instead, the grandees themselves were only afforded rank in the viceroyalties, the burgeoning Spanish empire in the New World. Otherwise, Charles ruled through a series of councils, such as that of the Indies, giving rise for many historians to refer to his as a cabinet government. While these reforms strengthened Castile, which became the principal power base for Charles and the Spanish Habsburgs thereafter, his reform program represents the limit of his imperial ambition. In 1518, Charles had empowered Mercurino Gattinara as the Grand Chancellor of all the realms and kingdoms under the king. Here we have this wonderfully sinister betrayal of him by Vermeyen, rendering him as a severe potentate, you can see on the right here. With the demise of de Croix, Gattinara fully intended to impose his vision of a grand dynastic empire with common institutions through the enlargement of his own chancellery to supervise the government of all of Charles's domains. Nevertheless, the reform process that had started in Castile was localized to Castile. Of the rest of Charles's Spanish inheritance, mainly Aragon, Sicily, and Naples, viceroys were appointed, but the ancient system of administration remained, giving rise to the notion that Charles considered himself as the lord of many nations, governing in accordance with the customs and interests of the various peoples of those states, whether they be Italian, Burgundian, or Spanish. The multifaceted, multinational character of Charles is perhaps summarized by his famous saying, "I speak Spanish to God, Italian to women, French to men, and German to my horse." The Comuneros revolt had nearly cost Charles the throne of Castile. Thereafter, his rule became more parochial, more Iberian, cemented by his marriage to Isabella of Portugal and his learning of Castilian. That his reform project among his Spanish possessions stopped in Castile ensured that Castile would remain the principal power base of the Spanish Habsburgs. Charles's actions in Spain give substance to perhaps the greatest of his failings, that with the Comunero revolt and the subsequent reform effort in Castile, Charles was fundamentally reactive, basing his policy off necessity, of survival, rather than relying on his own initiative, appealing to a political vision and attempting to execute such a vision in a premeditated fashion. De Croix, during the first 5 years of Charles's majority, had pursued a Francophile foreign policy. Arguably, treaties such as Nyon had secured Charles a smooth transition and ascension to the thrones of Spain. Nevertheless, De Croix had now fallen from favour. Charles had secured his respective thrones, and the ambitious Ghibelline Gattinara had become Charles's principal influence. As a Ghibelline, an advocate for the Roman and universal conception of Charles's principality, Gattinara believed that the centre of the emperor's power must be in Italy. Francis, as mentioned on our previous episode, had already retaken Milan and defeated the Swiss, resurrecting French fortunes in the Italian Wars. Nevertheless, French incursions into Navarre and Burgundy were easily repulsed, and Charles then formed an alliance with Pope Leo X, the cities of Mantua and Florence, driving all the French garrisons out of Italy. After a counterattack by France, Francis succeeded in capturing Milan again. Imperial forces, under the command of French turncoat the Duc de Bourbon and Lannoy, decimated the French nobility and captured Francis himself at Pavia. Gattinara advocated that Francis be released on harsh terms, including his renunciation of all claims to Italy and the return to the Habsburgs of the entire Burgundian inheritance that Louis XI had partially seized in 1477. To Gattinara's dismay and condemnation, to such an extent that he refused to place his seal on the peace treaty, Francis was released on the strength of a promise to fulfill those conditions. Francis was a king, and Charles, as a fellow monarch, treated him in kind, expecting that Francis would conduct himself in the chivalrous manner befitting his status and imitating his predecessor, John the Good, who had been captured by the English during the Hundred Years' War, and upon breaking a contract with England, voluntarily submitted himself to be a hostage of the English. Such grand notions of chivalry meant nothing to Francis. Once released, Francis repudiated the agreement and sponsored the League of Cognac, an alliance of the smaller states of Italy against Habsburg hegemony. Pavia had seemingly amounted to nothing. To prevent the papacy switching sides, Charles supported the Colonna family against the Medici and their Pope Clement VII. To Charles's dismay, the Colonna were easily defeated by Clement, causing the Colonna to appeal to the Duc de Bourbon in Milan. Bourbon's army, however, composed of German mercenaries, unpaid and restless Lutheran landsknecht, and rather than aiding the Colonna cause, they instead infamously sacked Rome in the year 1527, providing the French with moral impetus to invade Italy, even reaching Naples for the first time in 25 years in concert with the Genoese, though the French forces later succumbed to cholera. While the Italian wars continued intermittently for the next 30 years, the French abandoned Milan in return for the Habsburgs renouncing French Burgundy and Gattinara's principal goal of expansion. The Sforza dynasty in Milan would fail. Thereafter, the Habsburgs took possession of the duchy until the unification of Italy in the 19th century. Upon Charles's arrival in Italy and coronation in Bologna as emperor, Habsburg and Catholic authority in Germany was in freefall, and the Ottomans were expanding aggressively into Europe. Maximilian I had received his coronation by proxy. something afforded to all future emperors after Charles. And yet the fact that Charles undertook this voyage to be personally crowned by the Pope is emblematic of his conception of rulership and his own imperial mission. As the sword and shield of Christendom, he must reform the church and combat heresy. Universal peace among Christians, a new Pax Romana, was seized upon by the humanists in Charles's Spanish court, coupling this notion to the old Ghibelline conception of the emperor as universal and spiritual head. Gattinara's conception was clear, that Charles, as the successor of Charlemagne, had the duty to arrive at a universal peace, which cannot be achieved without world monarchy. The sack of Rome was a positive development for Gattinara, as it signified the temporal disempowerment of the Pope vis-a-vis the emperor. Universal monarchy was not synonymous with universal empire, however. Habsburg dynastic holdings possessed their own customs, local magnates, and languages. Outside of the possessions of the emperor, the sovereignty of Europe's royalty and the rights of the nobility were to be held sacrosanct. I relayed this back to the motto of Maximilian I, cited during the episode The Rise of the Habsburgs, Bella Ganat Alii, tu Felix Austria Nubi, let others wage war, but you, happy Austria, shall marry. Namque Mars Alius, dat tibi regna Venus, for those kingdoms which Mars gives to others, Venus gives to thee, and the motto of Frederick III, which is often rendered in English, as all the world is subject to Austria. Marriage and dynasty would be the force for making unity. The king over all was meant to be the king of each. Europe's royalty could be envisaged as an enlarged version of the Grand Burgundian Order of the Golden Fleece, with Charles as its Grand Master. In continuation with his grandfather's policy, albeit with less dramatic success, Eleanor Habsburg was married to King Francis of France, Philip to Mary of Portugal and later England. Members of the dynasty were a reservoir of princely officials to govern the empire, as Charles has shown in Austria with Ferdinand and later with his own son Philip in Spain. The production of Habsburgs and the unity of the Habsburg patrimony was key to this conception of empire. This dynastic obligation carried over from administration into the defence of the church. To be a Habsburg was to be a Catholic, lest the unity of Christendom be torn asunder. Combine this with the Spanish zeal of the Reconquista to defend and expand the Catholic faith. Unity in Christendom would be a prelude to a crusade against the Ottomans to liberate the cities of Constantinople and Jerusalem. In the Mediterranean theatre, Charles' Italian allies had already facilitated his dramatic conquest of Tunis from the Ottoman admiral Barbarossa. However, when discussing the theory of universal monarchy, we should not lose sight of the fact that the monarchy, as it existed under Charles, was idiosyncratic, an empire of complexity and contradiction. Charles finally returned to Germany to convoke the Diet of Augsburg in 1530, with the aim of securing a ceasefire in Germany, in order to combat the Ottomans following the unsuccessful Ottoman siege of Vienna the year before. It became apparent, however, that without a religious settlement, progress would be impossible. Charles appeared ready to support the compromised Catholics, who penned the document the Confutation. War between the religious groups was considered by Charles as a last resort. Instead, a general ecumenical council of the church was proposed as a means to bring the Lutherans back into communion with the Pope. Clement VII balked at this idea. From Popes Nicholas V to Leo X, the church had moved away from the provisions of the Council of Constance, namely the calling of regular church councils, leading to the rise of conciliarism, the idea that the council is superior to the Pope in matters of doctrine. That very council was convened on the initiative of an emperor, Sigismund, which successfully ended the tripartite Western schism of Roman, Pisan, and Avignon sees. A potential synthesis of Ghibellinism and conciliarism existed in the Reformatio Sigismundi, a collection of documents associated with the reign of the Emperor Sigismund a century prior, later penned anonymously and presented at the Conciliarist Council of Basel, which indicated support of church secularization and even the ending of clerical celibacy. Even after the death of Gattinara, conciliarism had a profound influence on the Ghibelline imperial faction, as exemplified by Alvarez Guerrero's treatise on a general council of the church, or Tractado. Clement VII deduced that any such movement convened under the auspices of Charles would see a diminution of papal authority in line with the Ghibelline goals of Charles's advisers. In the event, the intransigence of the Lutherans over the insistent return of church property and revenue and the looming threat of military intervention by Charles caused the Protestant princes to construct a defensive league at Schmalkalden, the Schmalkaldic League. Peace was nonetheless preserved for over a decade, during which Lutheranism spread from Swabia and Saxony to the Hanseatic League towns and Brandenburg. As Protestantism gained strength, the League was content to wait for the Habsburg response rather than force it. Francis, meanwhile, was sending friendly overtures to the League, intimating a French intervention in the event of a German civil war on the side of the Protestants, while at the same time concluding his infamous alliance with Suleiman the Magnificent, making a nonsense of Charles's attempts at a Christian peace, even from his Catholic peers. Both Henry VIII of England and Christian III of Denmark declared their support for the League. Unwilling to reduce the Protestants by force, Charles appealed again to an ecumenical council, with Clement's objections increasingly difficult to justify, given the scale of the crisis. Before his death, Clement had turned definitively to France, even concluding a marriage pact between Catherine de' Medici, his niece, and Henry, later Henry II of France. Alessandro Farnese was then elected as Paul III, yet petty intriguing, often at the instigation of the French, stalled the calling of a council. The papal, imperial, and Protestant positions were ultimately intractable. Charles attacked the vacillation of the Pope, and yet he had every cause for concern. The Pope would not countenance the reduction of papal power, nor compromise with heretical doctrine. Charles saw in the council, in political terms, as a means of restoring the unity of the empire and Christendom by extension, even if it meant a compromise on doctrine. It should be noted, however, that Charles was a devout Catholic and committed to following the Pope in matters theological, though Charles wished for the Pope to adopt a posture of conciliation, especially if Charles could get the Protestants to negotiate. In this vein, Charles attempted to foster dialogue between factions through the colloquy of Regensburg in the hope that the colloquy would open the path to a general council. The Protestants, however, insisted on debarring the Pope in any such council, making the effort futile. The failure of the colloquy forced Charles to accept the inevitability of war with the Protestants. The position of Charles V during the 1530s resembles that of an early modern Heraclius, beset by both an indomitable Islamic military threat to the East and an intractable religious controversy at home. At that time, between the Chalcedonian Christians and the Monophysites in the case of Heraclius, the resolution proffered by Heraclius and then ecumenical patriarch of Constantinople, Sergius, was of a compromise doctrine to unify the factions in the form of monophysitism, a compromise ultimately rejected by both sides of the divide and was itself declared heretical by a subsequent council, despite having originally received the full support of the emperor. Had the Pope and Charles acted to implement some equivalent compromise doctrine, it may have been rejected by Catholics and Protestants alike and damaged the standing of both the emperor and the papacy. In 1544, 14 years after the Diet of Augsburg, Paul III published Laterae Jerusalem, summoning a council of the church in Trent. Rather than proving a relief to Charles, the council was a catalyst to war. Trent confirmed Catholic doctrine as inimical to the Protestants, who soon rejected the council at Worms. The compromise effort of the last 14 years under Charles had proved utterly futile. And what was now the case was that the empire was weakened at the height of its conflict against France and the Ottomans. Charles himself had been campaigning in Algiers at this time. By now, the Protestant powers had formed a formidable power block in northwest of Germany, cutting off Austria from the Netherlands. Munster was under the influence of Protestant Hesse, Cologne, and converted, and Cologne had already converted under a single archbishop, while Catholic Brunswick, right in the heart of northwestern Germany, had been conquered by forces of the League. With the conversion of the Elector Palatine, the link between Austrian possessions in Swabia and the Netherlands was effectively severed. A diet at Regensburg was convened by Charles as a final gesture of reconciliation to the Protestants. When the League leaders failed to attend, Charles, now vindicated that his enemy was set on confrontation, placed the ban on the leaders of Hesse and Saxony. In a daring winter campaign, Charles quickly defeated the Schmalkaldic League at Mulburg and achieved the full surrender of the League's leaders. In 1547, it appeared that Charles was triumphant. Charles's Catholic allies were restored to the north, while John of Saxony and Philip of Hesse were imprisoned in the Netherlands. That same year, Francis died, ridding Charles of his most tenacious rival. Marlborough, though a military triumph, was a political failure. Charles was still dependent on both Protestant princes and Catholic princes to govern the empire. When he convened a diet in Augsburg, aiming at centralizing imperial control, his designs were rebuffed and later abandoned. Charles's victory at Marlborough had elevated a Protestant prince, Maurice, at the expense of his former enemy, John of Saxony, Maurice receiving the elector's title in lieu of John. And yet, Charles was unwilling to support his new Protestant ally, even threatening to release John of Saxony should Maurice prove disloyal. Fearing for his position, Maurice formed an alliance with Henry II of France, the League of Liberty and Freedom, and invaded Swabia, while Henry took the imperial cities of Metz, Verdun, catching Charles completely off guard. Subsequent attempts to recover Metz from the French failed, leading the three bishoprics of Metz, Verdun, and Toul to fall into possession of the French. His military position in Germany broken, Charles entered into a deep depression, unable to resist the demands of the Lutheran princes. He developed insomnia, alternating between states of weeping and vacancy, unwilling to discuss matters of state or sign any official documents. Instead, he developed a compulsive need to ensure that all of the timepieces surrounding him ticked in syncretic unison. His physical health was failing also, as the emperor suffered from gout. Charles's final act as emperor was to consent to the Peace of Augsburg, granting permanent concessions to the Lutherans, officiating the religious division of the empire forever. This disaster for the emperor was compounded by the failure of Charles's dynastic policy. Charles, out of necessity, had raised his brother Ferdinand to be the King of the Romans and Archduke of Austria. Ferdinand would become emperor. Now the question remained as to whether Ferdinand would be succeeded by Charles's son Philip or his own son Maximilian. In 1551, Charles had arranged a compromise. The heads of the Spanish and Austrian branches would alternate possession of the imperial title. Philip would be elected King of the Romans, concurrently with Ferdinand's accession, while Philip would marry his cousin, Ferdinand's daughter. The unity of the House of Habsburg would thus be maintained, while the weaker possessions of the Austrian branch would be militarily and economically integrated with the Spanish Empire. Maximilian had no interest in being dispossessed, and so negotiated with electors directly behind Charles's back, with Ferdinand's blessing. Philip also had no desire to follow his father's direction either, pursuing his own marriage policy, and ultimately renouncing Charles's compromise. With this ultimate failure, Charles resolved to abdicate all of his thrones, a process beginning with Burgundy in 1555 and ending with the imperial title in 1556, after which he retired to a Castilian monastery and died 2 years later. The division of the House of Habsburg was thus confirmed, and Ferdinand's heirs would inherit the Habsburg monarchy and the imperial title, while Philip inherited the direct possessions of his father, the Burgundian inheritance, the possessions in Italy and Spain. Thanks to Charles's strengthening of the Castilian crown and failure to provide his domains with an overarching system of governance, the Grand Chancery project of Gattinara having all been abandoned, the state of Philip and his successors was less a universal monarchy than a Spanish one. The division of the House of Habsburg was as much ideological as it was territorial. Under Ferdinand and his immediate successors, the Austrian branch would continue in Charles's spirit of compromise with the Protestant princes of Germany, while the Spanish branch under Philip II would mobilize all the resources of the New World to zealously propagate the Catholic faith. Charles's abdication was an acknowledgement that his project of a Catholic Habsburg Pax Romana, a universal monarchy, as conceived of by Gattinara, had failed. Yet while his goals of unity and conquest went unfulfilled, Charles left the Habsburgs in a formidable position. The Spanish inheritance in Europe and the New World left Philip II as the greatest prince in Christendom. Ferdinand in Austria had expanded Habsburg rule to Bohemia and parts of Hungary, while the joint efforts of Charles and Ferdinand had prevented further Ottoman expansion into Europe. Charles had successfully stymied the French under Francis I, decided the Italian wars in the Habsburgs' favour, and facilitated the Council of Trent over French intrigues. The Council of Trent itself, though failing to bring about religious reconciliation in the empire, started the Counter-Reformation and the revival of Catholic fortunes in Europe. I would like to finish this on a note about Charles's character. Charles has often been lambasted as a stubborn, reactionary monarch, a medieval throwback. Even the existence of his composite monarchy is held in stark contrast to the rise of nation-states throughout Europe, whether that be Henry VIII's England, Francis I's France, or Gustav Vasa's Sweden. While this is meant as a term of derision, I consider it a compliment. While Henry VIII was dissolving monasteries, augmenting his royal power, Charles cast himself in the role of the church's standard bearer. While Francis was seeking to undermine the integrity of the Holy Roman Empire, the interests of France being paramount above all, Charles held the interests of Europe and Christendom as paramount in opposition to the rise of the Ottomans, to which Francis responded by allying with the Ottomans. When Louis XI, Francis's predecessor, had used every expedient to centralize the French state, Charles's restraint beyond Castile and arguably the Netherlands, even at the cost of his own power, could be cast as weakness or a recognition of and defense of European particularism. While his contemporary in Russia, Ivan the Terrible, had dealt with rebellious nobles via the Opichnina, a state-sanctioned campaign of terror, Charles, in the face of intractable political and religious opposition in the empire, advocated for tolerance and compromise over force, even though such a policy of prevarication cost him dearly. Rather than eliminate his dynastic rivals, he empowered them. Perhaps had Charles resorted to harsher tactics, he would have made for a more effective ruler. Had he properly exploited the capture of Francis at Pavia, as Gattinara wished, had he dispatched the Protestants with military force after the Diet of Augsburg, 15 years before he decided to do so. His chivalry may have been a political failing, but perhaps alone Charles can boast of virtue in stark contrast to the machinations of his rivals and contemporaries. Charles, despite his best efforts and military feats, was seldom in control of events, his reign echoing that of the great Emperor Heraclius and even the mystical King Sisyphus, perpetually rolling the boulder up the hill, only for it to fall again and again on the cusp of the precipice, a pure exercise in futility. The failure of Charles's was Europe's loss and spelled the end for the political realization of the Ghibelline imperial idea. Now, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I've noticed that we do have a couple of super chats, so I'll just read them quickly and then I'll be off, if that is all right. So just, right. Polish ambassador for 25 zloty, thank you very much. Sun Never Set Empire might be a good episode to ask about the famous European balance of power. Papa AM tells us its history and recognition among players. Are you talking about England in particular? Or, you know, the build-up towards the First World War? Because, yes, I mean, we will get to that eventually. I mean, this channel hasn't really focused on any sort of extra-European powers. It's mainly been focused on European history thus far. But as this channel is able to cover more and expand beyond Europe, I definitely want to cover something like that. So absolutely. Thank you, Polish ambassador. Winter Phoenix Forest Kirin for $5. Nice channel, AM. But the way the Japanese tell it, a lot of these wars were actually led by teenage Japanese-speaking girls. Is that true? Well, I guess that's a humorous allusion to all of the anime profiles. I'm sure after this, or there has already been created an anime profile of Charles V. So yes, probably someone can show me that later and horrify me. But thank you for that super chat, Winter Phoenix Forest Kirin. Anyway, thank you very much. Those are all the super chats and questions for this evening. I want to thank you again for listening. And a reminder that in just over 2 hours, Columba and Marcus Pierce Pertinax and I we'll be discussing this topic and going over some articles. So I really hope you can join me again, along with the rest of the crew there. Anyway, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.